Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Funny, isn't it, that jobs is actually a four-letter word? The politics of how to fix the American economy on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Innocentive, solving important problems for business, government, and foundations by connecting them to problem solvers from around the world. Innocentive.com, where the world innovates. And by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 11th of October. Good to have you with us. President Obama went to Pittsburgh today. Union visit, a speech or two, pretty basic politicking trip. Except for this, as a dubious Senate takes up his $447 billion jobs bill, the president said he is ready to do what it takes to get even a part of it to pass. It's a mix at the moment of tax cuts and infrastructure spending, but political reality being political reality, there is already talk of Plan B. What can be salvaged that both Democrats and Republicans might find a way to support? From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Frank Newport's got a finger on the pulse of public opinion. He's the editor-in-chief of Gallup.
Taken as a whole, Americans want the government to do something.
But polling also tells us something else about what the public's thinking. Michael Dimmick is associate director of the Pew Center.
There's a lot of skepticism about what the government can really do about the situation.
And that's because there isn't agreement on the jobs bill or how to pay for it. Most Senate Democrats favor a higher tax on millionaires, and a recent poll shows the majority of Americans also support that idea. But without bipartisan backing, the Senate's Democratic leadership is trying to salvage what it can, moving toward a smaller Plan B. Trading, say, a national infrastructure bank for a corporate tax holiday. Andrew Fieldhouse is with the Economic Policy Institute.
I think provisions of this could pass independently, but I don't think you're going to get the scale that you need to make a real dent in the unemployment rate.
About half the president's jobs plan is new spending, money for rebuilding roads and bridges, refurbishing schools, and rehiring teachers. Gallup's Frank Newport says that in a recent survey, he asked Americans what they'd do to create jobs.
And spending more on infrastructure was volunteered more than any other response that we found.
But spending's not the bulk of this bill. Isabel Sawhill is with the Brookings Institution.
The jobs bill is overwhelmingly tax cuts.
Some economists say you need both tax cuts and infrastructure spending to add a few million more jobs. But in Washington today, something, anything, may be better than nothing. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There's another job story out there today, albeit one that's not going to get sympathy from a whole lot of people, at least at the headline level. Professional basketball players are going to be getting some unwanted bench time because late last night, NBA Commissioner David Stern canceled the first 2 weeks of the regular season. Owners and players haven't been able to come to terms on a revenue-sharing deal, which means less revenue all the way down basketball's economic food chain. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles can hold almost 20,000 people. Without a game, that's a lot of folks who won't be stopping by Casey's Irish Pub, just a few blocks from the arena.
We're going to lose a lot of business due to this.
General Manager Jeff Marino says lost Lakers and Clippers games equals lost revenue.
That's going to be a couple $1,000s a game, you know, at three or four games a week. That adds up.
Restaurants next to Staples Center also see a lot more business on game nights. Take the Polynesian-themed Trader Vic's. John Valencia is one of the restaurant's partners.
We normally will do between $25,000 to $30,000 on one of those Laker nights, depending on who they're hosting.
John Blank is deputy chief economist with the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation. In adding up the economic impact of an NBA game, he counts about $200,000 in concession sales, plus meals at nearby restaurants.
If you add $10 on average to parking, there's another $200,000. So what I get is $800,000 in a back-of-the-envelope type of calculation.
That's $800,000 in direct economic impact from one single sold-out game. That's excluding ticket revenue, which is divvied up between owners and players, so it doesn't really trickle down. Blank says fans can use the money they save on tickets to support the local economy beyond Staples Center. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Most of us know that you can, in fact, get too much of a good thing. Today, the journal The Archives of Internal Medicine gave us the science, at least as it relates to dietary supplements. Daily multivitamins and minerals might actually do more harm than good, the research shows, which is kind of disheartening given that we spend $28 billion a year on all that stuff. Marketplace Jennifer Collins has the story.
By some estimates, as many as half of all Americans take some kind of supplement. And the habit starts early. Remember this jingle?
We are playing Stones.
Susan Fisher chairs the Department of Preventive Medicine at the University of Rochester. She says it's in our nature to go overboard.
In America, we have the tendency to think, gee, if one vitamin pill is good, maybe I'll take two today because I didn't eat very well.
But more isn't better. The new study looked at nearly 40,000 older women over a two-decade period. Researchers found women who took multivitamins or iron were slightly more likely to die during that period. Yako Mersu is the lead author of the study. He says the increase in risk wasn't dramatic, but
people think or they take supplements that they would get benefits, so that's still contrary to that belief.
Mersu says more studies are needed to know whether other factors like illness played a role in the deaths. Studies like this have done little to dent the supplement business. Steve Mister heads an industry group that represents the supplement makers.
People look at supplements as a kind of an insurance policy, that they're getting all the nutrients that they need.
Mister says sales continued to rise, even during the recession. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Lest you think this is just another Tuesday, allow me to intervene. This is, although it may have escaped you, the beginning of corporate earnings season. Alcoa is by tradition given the honor of kicking things off, which it did today after the bell. I could tell you what they said, but that'd spoil the fun. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Timing, it's often said, is everything, and that was certainly the case with the European debt crisis today. Just a couple of minutes after the closing bell on Wall Street this afternoon, the parliament in Slovakia said nuh-uh to expanding the European Financial Stability Facility. That's the big bailout fund that's supposed to help fix things over the year. There is going to be another vote, and the package will probably pass. But still, the fact that the fate of the global economy potentially came down to a former communist country that's the smallest and poorest in the Eurozone is kind of interesting. Anka Dragu is a reporter with Slovak Public Radio in Bratislava. Anka, good to have you here.
Hello.
How did the government try to convince the public and the other members of the coalition that this is something they needed to do?
it has been a very long battle because, of course, Slovakia has been a member of the Eurozone for 2 years, and the Prime Minister has tried to actually remind people that as a member of this exclusive club, to some extent, Slovaks also have duties. So no matter what they think about helping Greece, for example, their duty is to show solidarity with the other members of the Eurozone. So apparently she was not 100% successful because we have this junior member of the ruling coalition, the Liberal Party, Freedom and Solidarity. They pretend to be neoliberal, so they believe that markets are in charge of solving all these economic problems. And they think that this bailout fund is basically a completely inefficient solution and a waste of money.
When you go out on the street, though, and talk to ordinary Slovak citizens, what do they say about the prospect of them having to potentially pay more taxes to bail out a richer country like Greece?
That's a very sensitive issue, of course, because ordinary Slovaks like to use this example that, okay, my mom or my grandmother has a pension of maybe 300, 400 euro, while some Greek pensioner has some 1,500 euro. So why should I contribute to the pension of a Greek pensioner? This is the basic argument, let's say. Of course, people are unhappy because Slovakia has been undergoing some very painful reform in the past decade. And now the government of Prime Minister Iveta Radičeva has a very strict plan to cut the budget deficit. So you can imagine that people have had enough of budget cuts, and it's very difficult to sell this idea of even more reforms, even more pain, let's say, just for the sake of saving the Eurozone.
Do you look around at all? I mean, do the media look around, and do politicians look around and say, how did it come to be that the fate of the Eurozone rests on Slovakia?
Well, of course, it has been a sort of national debate, although not every single Slovak understands the background of this bailout fund and all this like stability mechanism schemes and so on. It was basically up to national parliaments to decide when they are going to vote on this proposal. And Slovakia, due to all these frictions in the ruling coalition, decided to be the last. I guess secretly they hoped that maybe other country will give a negative vote, so the problem will be solved before it will come to Slovakia.
Anka Dragu with Slovak Public Radio in Bratislava, the capital. Thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the great things about the economy is that it's quantifiable. You can measure stuff like gross domestic product and retail sales. But really, could that be more boring? Who can get excited about leading economic indicators, after all? So it seems to us what we need are some good offbeat alternatives, some trend that'll give us context about what's happening that straight statistics just don't. And that brings us to our series, Economy 4.0, which is all about how to make the global economy work better for more people and how to make it work better than to improve what we measure. Marketplace's David Brancaccio follows some of those alternative indicators. Hey, David.
Hey there, Kai.
So what do you got?
First, what you might call a few good men and women index.
All right.
Back in 2009, the New York Times reported that the recession meant that more people might be signing up for the Marines. This meant that the Marines could be more selective, so they toughened up their advertising campaign. At least that was the article then. But we just talked to Colonel Michael Bowersox, Assistant Chief of Staff for Recruiting at the Marines, and he says the Marines have been consistent with their message. You know, if you're a, quote, tough elite warrior, then maybe you can be one of us. But the recession has changed the following for the Marines: their retention rate. Not as many people want to leave in a down economy. So there's a lot of competition for the spots that are left.
When young men and women come into our office and want to join, they're very disappointed to find out that they're going to have to wait anywhere from 6 to 10 months before they can go to recruit training.
Sounds counterintuitive, right, David? The Marine Corps doing well when most of us are doing worse.
Yeah, exactly. For both human beings and, surprisingly, for pets. In 2008, if you're listening to Marketplace, you heard one of our colleagues talking about people needing to give up their pets for economic reasons. And when the economy tanks, animal shelters start to fill up. So we're curious how it's going now. And we called out to Arizona, which, of course, has been at the center of the foreclosure crisis. We talked to Bretta Nelson with the Arizona Humane Society. She says since the start of the recession, over a third of the emergency calls they receive are people reporting pets that have been abandoned.
The owners have either been evicted or left the home with no intention of returning. And it doesn't appear that those calls are increasing necessarily, but they are definitely staying very high and very consistent.
All right, I'm just looking down my list of things we were going to talk about, and I see next is, and I hesitate to mention this, the men's underwear index.
The theory is during bad times, we're less likely to replace our boxers and our briefs. Now, I wouldn't
I know.
Right. I wouldn't have brought the tone of this conversation down this far if the source had not been so exalted.
Give it up. Who is it?
Well, back in the 70s, before he was Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan ran his consulting firm. And one way he kept track of the economy was by looking at offbeat economic indicators like the Men's Underwear Index, MUI, for those in the know. Here's the theory that when you're feeling strapped for cash, you're less likely to replace your undergarments, even though most people see underwear as a necessity, right? Not a luxury.
Yeah, no. So one's obliged to ask, David, how are sales now?
Well, we did check, and according to an analyst who tracks these things, underwear sales for the NPD group, sales currently are up 5.2%.
You heard it here first, folks. Marketplace's David Brancaccio in our series Economy 4.0. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, taking pictures, defining a city.
I only knew the Detroit that had a high crime rate, high unemployment, abandoned buildings. So it's kind of my own curiosity in trying to understand the city better.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the markets took kind of a breather today. The Dow Industrials parted with just 16 points, about a tenth of 1%, ended at 11,416, the blue chips did. Just a day after that index scored its biggest gain in 2 months, by the by. The NASDAQ added 16 points, two-thirds of 1%, closed at 2583. The S&P 500 stood pretty much still, closed flat at 1195. U.S. bank stocks like Bank of America are sensitive to Eurozone worries, but still, B of A pocketed around 1.5% today. Alcoa, here comes the payoff, added 2% before the closing bell, and then the country's largest aluminum producer sliced off 4% in after-hours trading. The bellwether said third-quarter profits jumped from a year ago, but revenue slipped from the second quarter. London's FTSE stood in place today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Harper Business, publisher of Jim Collins' new book, Great by Choice, exploring why some companies thrive despite immense uncertainty, wherever books are sold. By CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on improving the congressional budget process. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. And a House subcommittee on national security discusses how to transition to a civilian-led mission in Iraq. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. APM is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back in June, while we were reporting from Shanghai, we spent a rainy Saturday afternoon at the local marriage market. It's literally a place where parents go to advertise the availability of their grown yet unmarried children. It was kind of amazing to see, but not at all uncommon over there. Given the changes, though, that China's going through, this next step was entirely predictable, the rise of online dating. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz has more now on internet romance with Chinese characteristics.
On a popular Chinese dating show last year, a male contestant invited an attractive young female contestant for a ride on his bicycle. The woman was quick with a response. I'd rather cry in a BMW than smile on the back of a bicycle with you. The comment sparked a national debate about the priorities of young urban Chinese.
As women get better educated and have better jobs, they really expect a lot from the guys.
That's Dr. Li Song. He's the CEO of the popular Chinese dating site, Zhenai. Like most dating sites in China, the first thing you see when you pull up a profile in Zhenai is your potential date's monthly income. It makes sense in China. Wages are low, competition for good jobs fierce, and the cost of living in the cities has risen to levels rivaling New York. Shang Ku of rival dating site Jiayuan says China's young people don't have time for flirting, and there are certain details that are really important.
One of our search criteria is where your hometown is or where your ancestral home is. There's a lot of local dialects. Some people would prefer to speak with someone in the same local dialect.
Both Jiayuan and Zhenai are good at taking old Chinese courtship traditions and modernizing them online. For example, in old China, if you were looking to marry, your family would hire a local matchmaker. From the offices of Zhenai in Shanghai, meet the modern matchmakers. Several young women sit at desks in a cramped office talking to clients. Zhenai's user fee is on the high end, around $500 for a six-month membership. But that'll get you assigned to your very own real-life matchmaker. Just like a matchmaker in traditional China, she'll do the dirty work so you won't have to. For example, want to know if your date owns his own home? Zhenai founder Li Song.
These are the sort of questions that people are reluctant to ask directly. So we have our matchmakers to answer these questions for them and other very personal questions.
Matchmakers also help you keep your dating schedule straight. Matchmaker Cao Xian is on the phone with a Mr. Wu, a rather busy bachelor from Hangzhou.
What time do you want to meet Li Xing? After you meet with her, you'll meet with Miss Feng after she gets off work. Miss Zhao, the taller one, the prettiest one, she doesn't have time tomorrow, but she wants your email address.
Zhenai has more than 800 matchmakers at call centers throughout China. Most of them at this office are young women in their 20s. Not what you might expect, but Cao says in today's China, the only people who truly understand young single Chinese are other young single Chinese.
We understand what's important to them, and we're very dedicated. The longest call I've had with a client was 6 hours. Sometimes I'll accompany the couple on their date if I'm worried they're too shy.
This personal touch helps. Zhenai's Li says 90% of its members decide to exclusively date another member within half a year. That's what happened to Huang Tao. Mr. Huang says his matchmaker gave him crucial dating advice.
She told me not to take the girl to a fancy restaurant on the first date. That would set expectations too high. She told me it would be better to meet at McDonald's or KFC.
Huang thought about it. In the end, he took his first date to a bakery. Mission accomplished. Huang and his wife, Nuo Li, are now happily married with a newborn daughter. Nuo Li says she loves her husband because his life doesn't revolve around money, but family. And it's obvious he adores her. And in today's increasingly urban China that's becoming a lonely place for some, that's worth much more than a BMW. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The Occupy Wall Street protests moved uptown today. In New York, people took to the streets and marched past the homes of some of the rich 1% they've been protesting against for a month or so now. Elsewhere, things continue. More than 50 demonstrators have been arrested in Boston. And on Friday, Detroit is scheduled to join what is now known simply as the occupation. It's not so hard to imagine why Detroiters might be frustrated. That city's been in a recession longer than most of the rest of us. There's chronic unemployment, rising crime, foreclosed houses everywhere, too. And that last bit is where photographer Kevin Bauman comes in. He's been taking pictures for years now of Detroit's abandoned and rundown homes. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You started taking these pictures back, what, in the mid-90s, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
How come?
You know, Detroit was a natural subject, considering it was what I considered my hometown. And I had always heard the stories my parents told me about how great Detroit was and the crowds that would go down there to the places like the Hudson's Building. And I never knew that Detroit. I only knew the Detroit that had a high crime rate, high unemployment, abandoned buildings. So it was kind of my own curiosity in trying to understand the city better.
Speaking of curiosity, there's a curiosity to these pictures because you can look at pictures that were taken 6 or 8 months ago and pictures that you took 15 years ago, and it's almost timeless, right? This image of an abandoned house over time.
Yeah, and in Detroit, unfortunately, that's the case. You can't tell whether this is Detroit circa 1995 or Detroit 2011. There are a lot of abandoned structures there. I think at last count, somebody said 40,000 or so.
There is one that's on the website, and we've got it up there now. It's marketplace.org, and all you have to do if you're looking, it's just click on that link that says abandoned houses. It's almost Gothic looking. It's got what look like towers, and it's old stone masonry, and it's clearly abandoned. Everything's boarded up. But on this picture and all the others, the only thing you see is the house. So I need you to give me some idea of the neighborhood and the surroundings of these places. Is it abandoned house after abandoned house after abandoned house?
You know, it all depends. That house was called the Lubin Apartments. A lot of these houses are so large that they were eventually turned into apartments as the wealthy folks moved out of that area and went further north or to the suburbs. This house, unfortunately, November 28th of last year, caught on fire. They think it was probably squatters and was razed later that day. So no longer is there, but much of the houses in that area are striking because they are large mansions and they are isolated. There isn't anything next to them.
It's interesting you mentioned that if you go there now, you know, a lot of these houses aren't there. I mean, we had the mayor of Detroit, Mayor Dave Bing, on the show maybe a year ago, and his proposal is to bulldoze a lot of these houses and just make everybody move to the core and concentrate Detroit.
Sure, right-sizing.
Yeah, that's right.
It's tough. You know, the ideal situation would be to reuse these, but I think the last census had Detroit's population at just over 700,000, and it was at one point almost 2 million. You know, I kind of understand the desire to do that.
Yeah. There is on your website, and work with me on this one here, it's vaguely like a real estate catalog. You know, like if you went to some realtor's website, you'd see row after row of houses.
Yeah, and I do. I get calls. In fact, I think I had one just on Friday of someone asking how they would purchase one of the houses.
Wow.
You know, the name kind of goes along with it, 100 abandoned houses. At the time, I kind of became obsessed with shooting them the same way, same angle, always the same kind of distance, trying to isolate the building. And then I could put, you know, all 100 of them together and it would have a lot of impact. And so that's why I did it. And it is kind of a catalog. It's a real estate catalog, but not in the typical way.
Yeah, no, not at all. Photographer Kevin Bauman. His website is called 100abandonedhouses.com. There's a link on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note today, which can only be filed under this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. There was a study out today on video games and how much more we're playing them, which we are, and which isn't all that surprising. Here is the surprising part. The NPD Group says the biggest increase in gaming use is by children aged 2 to 5, up 17% from a couple of years ago. Me? I blame Steve Jobs. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media, on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow sliced off 16 points, about a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq puffed up 16 points, or two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 pretty much stood still. It closed basically flat. Thanks to Doug Krisner, Ethan Lindsay, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here, mosquitoes and their cost to the African economy.
Malaria consistently costs the subcontinent of Africa over $40 billion a year because on any given day, one out of four members of the workforce is absent due to malaria.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.